Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Morse Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay. And tonight we have a very, very explosive broadcast for you this evening. We're going to be dealing with some things involving the courts. And we have our special guest here this evening, a brother from the northern parts of the United States. His name is a brother Kimitiu Bay, and he's going to be dealing with Federal Civil Procedure Title 28 USC Code, and this is some very important information. We're going to need you to get your pencil and paper handy so you can take notes. I have examined the brother on YouTube, and the brother has been doing a great work up north. And he's been actually beating them inside the court left and right. And he's going to give you all of the information that you need to know involving how to actually witness him teaching this information and bringing it to the people. But tonight we're going to be dealing with the following questions. Exactly what is the federal procedure? How is this process implemented? And what about state procedure versus federal procedure? He's going to give us the ins and outs of that. What about the civil procedure itself? How does these procedures play out in court? What about what part does the what do the lawyers do? What do they follow? What are they using? How do we win a case using this information? Can this keep me out of jail? And these are questions and much more are going to be answered tonight, and we're going to try to get it all in for you this evening. If not, then we are going to attempt to ask the brother to come back and give us part two of this thing. And so I need you all to sit tight, and we're going to deal with Federal Civil Procedure, Title 28 USC Code, and get this thing done. And so that you will clearly understand. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and please don't forget you can send for your free articles, the 14th Amendment, Exposed the Commerce Game, and the History of the United States. And the way you do that is just simply send me a little note at email, Tahaka53 at hotmail.com, and I'll get that to you. And for those of you who have not gotten a hold of the most comprehensive library inside the United States that we've created, you access that before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time by simply calling me at area code 904-303-9061 Eastern Standard Time, and we'll go ahead and get you in there. Now, without further ado, I'm going to bring my brother in, and keep in mind we got a hurricane going on the East Coast, so we're going to try to pull this thing off, but either way it goes, we're going to get the job done. Okay, so you all just sit tight. Area code 347. Last numbers ending in 1357. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind? Area code 347.
Islamo. Yeah, this is coming to you, Noble.
All right, my brother. Okay, we just want to make sure that the hurricane haven't done no damage up there, and we're ready to go.
It's trying to do damage up there. I mean, we're just in the beginning stages of it, so, you know, the wind is very strong up here. I hope it don't blow down no trees, but it's crazy. But in the meantime, we're going to get this knowledge on the road.
Okay, well, I'm certainly glad you are with us this evening, and everybody, we got the entire switchboard here lit up. And judging from the area codes, they're coming in from all over the United States, and I know we got much more. I'm going to open up the little chat room here and get that situated so we can get some feedback from there. And I want to start off by saying I want to give all praises to the Prophet Noble Drew Ali and to what he has done to make it possible for the Moors to get together and be able to do these type of things. And all the Moors online, we thank you all for being in. And, brother, I'm going to start off by letting you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got started with this thing and what's going on. You got the floor.
Well, you know, Moore, thank you for having me. It's an honor, you know, Noble, for me to be on your Blog Talk Radio. And basically, how it all got started for me, Noble, it was over 15 years ago, you know, I came, you know, more conscious is what I would say, because I would never say that I became a Moor, because it's impossible to become a Moor, because that is your birthright, all right?
That's right.
This is our birthright. This is who we are as a people, all right? So the European have robbed us of our birthright and our nationality. And as you stated, brother, if it wasn't for Prophet Noble Drew Ali, we wouldn't have this knowledge, and this goes back into 1913. And if you notice, Brother Tahaka, there's nobody out there in our community across the United States is teaching our people about their nationality and their birthright. Nobody's teaching this, all right? And the only one who brought that forth was Noble Drew Ali, Prophet Noble Drew Ali, and it was an honor that he had brought this to us to this day, that the teachings that he had brought us from 1913 all the way up to what you could say 2012, because 2013 is going to be the following year, you know, and that should be a big anniversary for Moorish Americans in reference to the Prophet, all right? Because again, you know, the 14th Amendment was a war amendment that was constructed, all right, to create citizenship for so-called Negroes. That's what that
right.
was. The Prophet himself had made it clear that in the Declaration of Independence that all men is created equal, so therefore there was no need for the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, all right? And so what is plaguing us today is these three amendments, all right? These three amendments are the amendments that they're keeping our brothers and sisters subjugated, all right? You will hear attorneys, judges, senators and congressmen, esquires and lawyers state that the Dred Scott case has been overturned by the 14th Amendment. But you'll be hearing it live from me, coming to you on this Blog Talk Radio, all right, that what they did was not overturn the Dred Scott. What they did was reconstructed the Dred Scott era up to this present day. Because if you notice, everything is based upon your status. All right? And I highly recommend for you to really acknowledge what the Prophet was coming from. All right? You got to read the three amendments, especially the 13th and 14th Amendment, all right? Then you have to go and start reading on the Dred Scott case. Read that. Very important that you read that. Then what you need to go and see is the Sons Free Moore Act of 1789 to 1790, Why am I making mention of that reference? Because our Moorish forefathers at that time, when they were captured to be made slaves down in South Carolina, these same Moors had purchased their freedom, their wives' freedom, their children's freedom. But when these Moors was freed from bondage from them Europeans, what the Moors did was they petitioned the house. The purpose of them petitioning the house is that if they were to be accused of a crime to become what? Amendable. These Moors wanted to make sure that their legal status would be secured, all right? And what they was referring to was that they don't want to be tried as under a Negro statute or the Black Act, all right? They wanted to be tried as a citizen of the state. At that time, so you don't hear this terminology that I'm about to share with you, it's called statesman. They had statesmen back there. You don't even hear that word in these days and time. But these our Moorish forefathers had a status of a statesman, all right? And so if you was going to try a Moor, even if they was accused of a crime, you wanted to try him as a statesman as opposed to being tried under the Dred Scott of the Negro Act or the Black Act, all right? Or the laws that govern free blacks, as they say, all right? And so this was, again, in 1789 to 1790, you could go research this information. And there was also other additional information that I want to bring out also that our brothers and sisters need to be aware. Abraham Lincoln was a trial attorney in a case, all right? And he was defending a client of his who hired him because a gentleman in the community was slandering his name by saying that he was a Negro, and because he was saying he was a Negro, it was hurting his business. So this particular brother hired Abraham Lincoln when he was an attorney at the time. This is before he was the president of the United States. And when Abraham Lincoln was hired, he declared that his client was not a Negro because to be a Negro is to be a crime, and that okay. He was a Moor. All right, so I'm going to get that case law. I didn't get to pull the case law yet, but I'm going to get the case. But I read references to that case law, but I want to actually pull that case law so that way our brothers and sisters can see what's going on with these terms, Negro, Black, and Colored. All right, and this is what I want to, you know, make sure our brothers and sisters be aware of. But in the meantime, Noble, of course, you know, our topic tonight is about civil litigation. All right,
okay.
And why would we do the civil litigation in federal court as opposed to state court? But we need to know state court civil litigation as well as we need to know federal court. But when it comes to your status as a Moor, it's very important to acknowledge on a federal level as opposed on a state level because the state's authority has been usurped ever since the Civil War. So at the time of the Sundry Free Moors, each state at that time was sovereign. Each state was sovereign at that particular time. Now, today, the states have, quote-unquote, quasi-sovereignty. So when you go to the United States Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, it specifically says there, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and in equity, all right, arising under this Constitution. The laws of the United States and the treaties made or which shall be made under their authority to all cases, all right? And so, again, you'll see why from this Article 3, Section 2 stresses the fact that this goes to all cases. So you have a better standing in federal court than you have in state court because the state courts are operating colorable. Not to say that the federal court cannot operate colorable either. But you have a better standing in the federal court. And we're going to definitely go into that because I know Brother Tahaka got questions for me to ask, answer, rather, I should say.
Okay. Well, I most certainly do, brother. And the first thing I want to start off in asking you, and I want to try to get down to the grassroots of this thing and deal with the Moors actually going through the procedures, because I've seen you on YouTube, and I know you teach step by step how to actually go through this. And I know you have beat them in the courts many, many, many times in doing this here. But before we get to the step by step procedure, I would like for you to clarify some of the terminology that you're using. And you say colorable, the difference between state and federal and stuff. Give us a little brief breakdown on that before we actually get into the how-tos of this thing, if you will.
Yes. What you have to go to what you call is the sixth edition of the Black's Law Dictionary. If you don't have that on hand, you can purchase that at Barnes & Noble, so if you can get that. Or you can go right online and you type in Black's Law Dictionary, and of course they will give you the definitions. All right. When we're talking about a term called colorable, this is a term that is actually in the Black's Law Dictionary. This is language that the European, who we misnomer as a so-called white man, uses in his legal lease or legal jargon. All right. And when you hear the term color of law, what they're referring to, so it can be clear for those out there who might have heard this for the first time, is that the states, all right, are any municipality or local government under the states or the state within itself, all right, are acting in what you call is ex post facto, which means there can be laws that are what you would call not de jure. De jure meaning standing law, all right, law where they have good standing, all right. These were laws that they had in the past that would keep us in these conditions that we're speaking about today, all right. And those laws have been changed over into a new statutory system of laws, all right. So any forms of the old law that's still being applied today in these new law times, when you start implementing the old laws into these new modern times, into the court system, those laws were considered to be de facto laws, laws that are unconstitutional, all right, laws that have what you call expired. They are still on the books, but yet they don't implicate those laws. So anytime someone is being subjugated to laws that's not active in de jure law, all right, that law is considered to be colorable, all right, or if they create a law that have not passed constitutional provisions concerning a state constitution or even a federal constitution, that would also be what you would call colorable law. All right, and a lot of that is going on today, all right, where you have judge-made law, all right. Judge-made law would be colorable law. And you say, what is judge-made law? Which means that, say, for instance, you have two parties, a plaintiff or a defendant, all right, and then what happens is that in the interim of the litigation process, the case comes to be disposed by a judicial decision. So when he decides that, it becomes a case law in point, all right, that can be used. But that's not a law that has been legislated, all right, and that's one of the problems that the judiciary is having with the legislators, because they are passing laws from a judicial perspective as opposed to complying what you call is the legislative law. And so anytime you see a judge passing some law or there's some case law that is not in the same regards of the statutes that the legislators have legislated as law for the judges to rule on, but the judges decide they want to rule on their own decisions and their own cases, all right, which is judge-made law, that's another form of what you call colorable law. So colorable law, again, to be clear, to be simple, is laws that is no longer active, all right? And so, and they'll take these laws that's no longer active or have not passed any constitutional provisions of the state or federal, all right, those laws were considered to be colorable, all right? That can be either by customs, that can be by ordinances, by usage, all right? And this is the language they use when you go to Title 42 of the United States Code, subsection 1983, you would actually see the veritable other language that they would use, that they would say that if you're being subjugated to any forms of usage, customs, ordinances, regulations, stuff to that nature, all right, that would consider to be called colorable law, all right?
Okay. Let me ask you this. Are you still with me?
Yes.
Okay. Let's say that we're going to say, and this is my understanding, let's say I was accused of robbing a bank, and I had to go to court, but I got out on bail, and I had to surmount a defense for myself, but I didn't want to use a lawyer. And how would I go about, what is the procedure that I would go about from the beginning to actually get in position to win this case? You know, regardless of whether I was guilty and not needing a law, how would I go about doing that?
Well, that's an interesting question, Brother Tahako, and this is what people need to be aware of. All right. First of all, when you're being falsely accused, as Tahako brought it out, the first thing you need to know is to get a copy of the file and see how you've been charged. All right. You have to find out if there's been an indictment. All right, if it's a misdemeanor, normally there won't be no indictment. Normally, the indictments will fall under the category of what you call as a felony. If you get a felony, you can rest assured that there will be an indictment. All right, you have to gather up all the necessary information, because that's one of the problems that our people are having when they are being charged. All right, guilty or not guilty is to start gathering up their file, all right? Because the first thing they're going to do is create a file on you, an index number or a docket number, and you need to get a copy of your file, all right? That's what you need to get, all right? You may not get that from the very beginning because they're trying to build up a case file against you, all right?
Okay.
But it will be there eventually, all right? Now, one of the most difficult things that one would face is trying to, quote-unquote, as they would say in court, represent yourself pro se, all right? And 9 out of 10, the court would always try to impose an attorney on you, all right, where it automatically gives the court jurisdiction over you, all right?
Right.
You know, once the court have done that. But let me be the first to tell you, all right, and this is very important that you be aware of this, is that, first of all, when you're standing before the magistrate, I call him the Magi in black robes, all right, because he's acting like a magician on the bench, you know, with all this legalese to try to entrap you with these terms that you may not be familiar with. But this is something that you need to know. First of all, they're all aware about a plea, all right, and your plea would always be non-assumption. All right, non-assumptive is a legal term that you can go look up in the 6th edition of the Black's Law Dictionary. And when you look up the word non-assumptive, non-assumptive is a plea, all right? And it means that you have not promised nor vert, all right, or agreed to enter into a contract, all right? Because 9 out of 10, when you're being charged, that is actually a contract, all right? And, of course, if it's a felony, of course, there's going to be what you call as a bill of indictment. That bill is actually a bill of equity, all right? So now we have to begin to start looking at the word abatement, all right? Because what you want to do is abate your case to zero, which means that you have to look at these charges and how you're being charged, all right? But let's look at this issue about a plea. I'm going to make this clear first before we move on, because we have to be clear about this plea. The game that the court play is they want to try to impose an attorney on you. But again,
okay,
that sixth edition of the Black's Law Dictionary, you must look up the word in propria persona. In propria, which is I-N, that's the preposition, I-N, pro, P-R-O, prior, P-R-I-A, persona, P-E-R-S-O-N-A, persona, and propria persona. It's very important that you look that word up. When you look up that word, it specifically tells you in the sixth edition of the Black's Law Dictionary that when one makes a plea, one must make a plea in propria persona. Listen to me carefully, family. This is how you will get them not to be able to put an attorney on your case if you're seeking to litigate your case, right, within
right.
your own standing. You must look at the word in propria persona. Go to the sixth edition, read it. Everyone must read it. When you read it, it's going to specifically say, if one makes a plea, one must make a plea in propria persona, which means that you have to make the plea in your own proper person, because if it's being pled by an attorney, it will be given the court jurisdiction, right? That's what it specifically says within that definition in the Black's Law 6th edition. But something else that you got to be aware of, and listen to this carefully, when you do make that plea in propria persona, that breaks the barriers of having an attorney on you, which means that the court cannot, by law, assign an attorney to you. And this is how they waiver it. When they assign an attorney, you got arrested, and you come
to the court. You're sounding kind of muffled, brother.
Excuse me?
You're sounding kind of muffled there.
All right. Yeah, because it's probably the signal, brother.
Okay.
Is it clear now?
I hear you clear now.
All right, good. It's probably the signal. The weather's really bad over here, so it's going to get some interference. But, yes, but please alert me, because I want to make sure that it's clear that once the court assigns an attorney to you,
okay,
how do you catch the court is to show the court that if you were to make a plea, you would have to make the plea in the proper persona, which means in your proper person. All right?
Okay.
When you say you do it in your proper person, that means that you cannot have any forms of representation. That's what that means. Any form of representation means that they usurp jurisdiction over your proper person. And that is a common law violation in reference to a criminal court. I just want to say that again. That is a common law violation in a criminal court, because one must make a plea in one's proper person, so it's impossible to make a plea with an attorney standing there. But what the court have a tendency to do when you have the attorney standing next to you, they have a tendency to ask you, well, sir, what is your plea? This is where we don't pay close attention to. This is the opportunity and time to say to the judge, I cannot make a plea in my proper person, long as I have legal representation next to me.
Okay, okay, hold, right. Let's make sure I understand this clear.
Yes.
All right. Now, we're going to say that we're standing before the bench right now.
Yes.
And now, Mosey, y'all need to pay attention, because I want to make sure I heard this right. The court has tried to, if I can't afford a lawyer, he's tried to assign me a public defender. And he's asking me, how do I plead? And I'm supposed to tell him at that point exactly what?
You told him exactly at that point it would be impossible for me to make a plea in propria persona, because the court had assigned an attorney to the case, which means that the attorney becomes your legal representative in the case. All right? So it will be impossible for you to make a plea, because when you go to the sixth edition, to the Black's Law Dictionary, it specifically tells you that when one makes a plea in propria persona, you must do it in your proper person. If it's done by an attorney, that means that you have court to usurp the jurisdiction over you, over your person, all right? And I'm going to be explaining some more information to give you some legal defense just beside the propria persona, suri juris. Is that clear, Noble?
Okay, that's clear to me, but let's make sure that we make sure that the average layman out there clearly understands what we're talking about. Let's start with proper person. Could you define that for us? The difference between all caps and the up and lower.
Yes. Well, again, you can go to the Black's Law Dictionary 6th edition again. Look up the word straw man, right? Look up
okay.
the word straw man, S-T-R-A-W, straw, and then man, M-A-N, and then look up the word attorney, A-T-T-O-R-N-E-Y. Look up those terms. Very important that you look up those two terms. I'm going to tell you why, so you'll know, because that's a reference point to give you an idea what's going on. And don't forget to look up in propria persona, all right,
okay.
which is a very important term. Now, this has to be clear. Right, in reference to what we don't want to prejudice ourselves, is that once you begin to start recognizing what is proper person, a proper person is what they're referring to, is you acting in your own natural capacity, which means in propria persona, listen to me carefully, we're going to use personal speech, so it can be articulated to the layman. It's a propria persona, which means in your own proper person. What are you talking about? All right, we have what you call is speaking in the first person, speaking in the second person, speaking in the third person. So when you ask the question, in propria persona, is that speaking in the first, second, or third person? Well, in propria means first. So all proper is referring to first. So what are you talking about? You will be the first person. But what happens is that once the court assigns you an attorney to be in the representative, you're no longer speaking as the proper party or the first person. It would be the second person, all right? The second person will be the attorney. He's going to be treating you like a straw man, all right, because of the fact that, first of all, as Tahaka stated it, they're treating you as though you are corporate fiction, all right? Where is that going back to? The Dred Scott case. Because in Dred Scott, Roger B. Taney, he was the same judge that said that corporations are persons, or all persons are corporations. Why did he say that? Because that's the fiction they was creating during the time of the Dred Scott era. Because if you go back in history, one thing that a slave cannot do is do what? Cannot be a plaintiff or cannot be a defendant in a case. A slave cannot have that status because he had no standing. All right, so
okay.
how do you create the standing for the slave? It's to give him the same status as a corporation. Yes, brother.
Now, we're going to say at this point that we understand, so we know at the outset that we are looking at our position and how they got our name spelled at the outset, because if we don't, and this is where I see it now, if we don't look at it at the outset and we mess around and grab some paperwork and it's got our name in upper or lowercase letters by some hook or crook, then we have to assume that they got us. But let's say that we know this. So after we have let the judge know that we cannot enter a plea, what next?
Listen to this, Noble, and that's a very good question, because it said what next. First of all, we must be prepared. That's the first thing. And let me give you a preparation first, so that way we can be clear. All those who are listening, and for those who are not on air, needs to get this information too. For those who are listening, it would be critical for you to pass this information to those who are not listening. And so let's look at the preparation first, because you have to have your standing first. And so let me express this to you. Every single last one of us who's in a state, it can be Florida, Maryland, California, Kansas, New York, New Jersey, Virginia, it doesn't matter what state you're in right now. Listen to me carefully. You must go to the State Department through a Freedom of Information request and request for what you call is a corporate negative search. And you'll say, what do you mean a corporate negative search? A corporate negative search is referring to the fact that if you want to start up a corporation, all right, in your name, you have to first find out if that corporation name is being used first, so you won't be sued for being infringed upon another corporate name, correct?
That's correct.
So listen to me carefully. When you do a corporate negative search, do a corporate negative search in your name in all capital letters and get it certified, whatever the certified fee is. New York State administrative fee in the State Department is $25. And that might have went up because every time you turn around, administrative fees go up. So every state's fees are different. So you can't base the fees here in New York for whatever state you're in. You have to find out what that administrative fee is in that state. And you want to get a corporate negative search in your name in all capital letters certified from the State Department. Why? Because anytime your name is being taken from you, which is your personal private property, and put into public record, all right, such as a court case, that is called an incorporated case. All right, they are indexing your name by title and incorporating your case. So it don't make a difference if your name is spelled with all capital letters or if it's spelled the common law proper, as a proper noun. It don't make a difference. If they put your name in a title action, indexing it or docketing it, all right, that is called an incorporated case. And the purpose of me putting out this information to get under a Freedom of Information request, requesting that you do a certified negative corporate search in your name in all capital letters, when it comes back to you from the State Department, they're going to state that no such name exists on their record. The reason why you get that document certified, because the next thing you're going to need is an affidavit of corporate denial. That would be your own personal affidavit, and you're going to have as an exhibit this certified document saying that this name in all capital letters is not in file or doing business within the state. The reason why I'm saying that is because once they put your name, indexing your name or documenting your name as an incorporated case, they have violated you to make you appear as though you are doing business in a corporate capacity. Very important to be aware of that.
Okay. All right. Now, before we get into the nuts and bolts and wiggle pins of what I want to do now is do what I call in my own little personal way on my little radio broadcast, is to get some station identification. Now, I know that I've seen you on YouTube deliver this thing straight from the hip like you got a 44 Magnum. Now, what I want to do is I want you to tell the audience how and where they can go see you and do this from start to finish from every conceivable angle. If you would tell us your YouTube, if you've got some kind of way for them to get in touch with you, so that, you know, let us have it.
Yes. I am presently at the National Black Theater in Harlem, New York. That's at 2031 Fifth Avenue. We're on the third floor every Tuesday between 6:30 and 9:30. I've been there for 3 years. It's the National Black Theater, 2031 Fifth Avenue, Harlem, New York. This is where we hold classes at, all right? What I'm going to be specifically doing in the future is setting up a video stream, a live video stream of the classes, so those who are in other states who cannot make the classes, they can see me live within the classroom setting, and you can also ask your questions in that video live stream so we can ask your questions right then and there. We're going to set that up shortly. Also, my telephone number is 347-626-1357. That's 347-626-1357. And my email, you can contact me by email. All right, that would be the quickest way you can get contact. Matter of fact, it's better than the U.S. Postal Mail. Is F like in Frank, U like in umbrella, R like in red, D like in David, E like in Eric, M like in Mary, U like in umbrella again, I like in ID, R like in red, at yahoo.com. I'm going to say it again. F like in Frank, U, R like in red, D like in David, E like in Eric, M like in Mary, U, I like in ID, R, at yahoo.com. You can send whatever request there to me, or you can send documents. If you want me to see any documents, anything that needs to be done, you can send it to my email and do me a solid. This is very important. Once you send something to my email in the title caption, please, it would be very important that you write it in capital bold caps in the title, subject box, because it's going to capture my attention, because I get so much emails and junk mail that I wouldn't want to overlook you, all right? You can call me, you can also text me, or you can even email me, all right? You can reach me at those three lines of communications, all right? And I will get back to you, all right? And I will respond to you, all right? So that would be the best way you can make contact with me at this present moment. But we will be setting up a live video stream, a classroom setting where we can get your questions online, and it's been read out in the class so people who's listening over the air or the video, they can hear your questions and it can be also answered. So you could participate in this particular video setting I'm going to be setting up pretty shortly. And you know, so that's my contact right there, Brother Tahaka.
All right. Now, Brother, before we get back into the meat of this thing, I'm going to open up a line. I see we got one caller, and then after that, then we'll go back on down into the meat. I'll place your contact number down in the chat forum, and what I usually do is I market this thing and I forward the information over and over and over again so they get a chance to listen to it and over again so they'll get all the information that I wasn't able to get, and I'll listen to it and I'll write it down and then repost it. But I'm going to open up the line and for a question and comment, and we're going to, let's see, area code 973. Could you tell us who you are, what are you calling from, what's your question and comment? Area code 973. You're on the air.
This is Zara. I'm calling from New Jersey Territory.
Okay, sister, let us have it.
I was going to ask the question about what to do when you do all that, you know, file a certain way, and the court still treats you like, well, you don't have a lawyer, because I've experienced this, because I'm about to refile two cases, two civil suits.
Okay.
All right, listen to this. it's very important to hear this, and I do hear what you're asking. A lot of our brothers and sisters across the country are having problems in the courtroom, and I know why. This is why this show is dedicated to those who are out there having problems, all right, because we're not understanding or comprehending what I should say, better word, we're not comprehending civil procedure, all right, and even criminal procedure, all right,
mm-hmm.
But procedure is the main idea that we need to look at. What happens is this is, the reason why these courts not only usurp jurisdiction over your person, all right, is they know that we don't know procedure, because a lot of brothers and sisters have filed documents into the court, and the courts see that the procedures are not correct, or the statutes may not be correct, or the form that is that they put in may not be correct. And that could be one of the issues. They're not going to tell you. One thing that the judge is not going to tell you. When they see something that's not correct,
mm-hmm.
they're going to, the first thing they're going to say to you, you need a lawyer. All right? Because they're going to assume automatically, as an assumption of law, that you don't know because you have no legal experience or legalese in your belt to deal with the legal problems they have. So now, sis, I have to ask you a question. All right, so I can see where you at with your case, because that's one of the things that we do on class on Tuesdays is we have an open forum. So it's not about me just teaching, all right, it's interaction with each other. We dialoguing, because to me, dialoguing is how I teach. Once I learn where you at, the solution where you need to be at. So you stated to me that you had a case in court, you have a case in court, and they said you needed a lawyer, and you said you filed some civil actions or documents in court. Now, what is the case for? So that way I have an idea so I can help you.
Well, actually, it's two different type of cases. It's one dealing with Child Protective Services, and the other is dealing with it's a criminal case where my husband was unlawfully and illegally arrested and detained or kidnapped, if you will, by fraudulent documents. And even with the Child Protective Services case, all that was fraudulent, and everything that was done through colorable law, and just they just basically did what they wanted to do. And at the time when when I filed it, I didn't half know what I was doing at all. So I didn't know about, you know, certain like you say, procedures. So they were kicking back everything I was doing. They was kicking it back, dismissing it.
Yes. All right. So listen to this, sis. All right. Because I did give my information, because we can be here all night long just on one case, and we only got 2 hours, and the show is not going to be that long. But listen to this. You have my number. You
mm-hmm.
can call me. All right. And I can get into more detail for you. But let me share this with you so you know what's going on. You have to go to the fourth edition of the Blackfellow Dictionary. For those who are listening, it's the fourth edition of the Blackfellow Dictionary, all right, because I read all the editions of the Blackfellow Dictionary, and
mm-hmm.
certain one of the dictionaries have a certain legal term, all right, where the other one may not have it. So could people ask me, well, what is the best dictionary in Black's law to read? I said, you have to read them all, because the information is in every single last one of them, and I don't have no prejudice on which Black's Law Dictionary. The one that I use the most is between the fourth and the sixth. All right? The fourth and the sixth is what I use. Of course, I use the seventh, the eighth. All right? I do use those also, because there's always new terms that's out there that's coherent with how the court is moving with these attorneys. So you have to be coherent to these legal terms or legalese that they're using. Very
mm-hmm.
important. Now, with your case, listen to this. There's two terms that we must know. Must look up these terms.
Okay.
Because then you're going to see a lot of your solutions in these terms, so that way when these documents are being put together, all right, they're going to recognize exactly what's going on, because they see what language you're using, and that
mm-hmm.
is the blind eye doctrine. All right? That's called the blind eye doctrine. You know, you can go to Google, all right, or go into Wikipedia, and type in blind eye doctrine. All right? That's one.
Or doctrine.
Yeah, blind eye. You know how they say that justice is blind?
Hmm.
All right? The blind eye doctrine is a doctrine where it refers to that, say, for instance, as an example, there could be a statute that can vindicate your husband or you, and they know you can be vindicated with this statute, but they choose to pursue you unjustly, all right?
Mm-hmm.
That's called a blind eye. They're turning a blind eye on the statute. They know that you can be vindicated because according to law, where there's an injury, there must be a remedy. For every injury, there got to be a remedy, all right? And,
mm-hmm.
of course, they always act as though there's no remedy there, but it is. So they're turning what you call as a blind eye, which is a blind eye doctrine. That's one. You can look that term up in the fourth edition of the Black's Law.
Okay.
All right. The other term is called altered ego doctrine. Altered ego doctrine means that they're operating in a corporate capacity. All right. They cannot act on someone else. All right, because a lot of these agencies, like, for instance, like the county attorneys, would be suing you on behalf of Child Protective Services. All right, this is what they will be doing. And it's all corporate because they're using these corporate statutes. That's another thing that we need to be aware of. I'm going to let everybody out there know, none of these statutes, I don't care if it's criminal or civil, don't even apply to you. I don't know if you're aware of that, but these statutes do not apply to you. Why? Because all those statutes are corporate, and you're all in your private capacity, and these statutes that they created is all public statutes. So they put you in what you call is a public record, and the Fifth Amendment is against that because you cannot take private property for public use without just compensation. So these people are out there operating under what you call is RICO concessions. There's nothing but a crime syndicate to take people's families and use corporate statutes, all right, to pull you out of your private capacity into a public capacity, and now you become public record. This is exactly what they do. So you need to also look up another phrase, all right? It's called the minimum contact doctrine. Minimum contact doctrine. Look those words up, family,
okay.
Because when you start looking up these words, then the light's going to come on in your head, and you're going to say, oh, I see what the brother's saying. Because there's a private side and there's a public side, all right? And in your private capacity, somewhere along the line, there has to be a line drawn between the public and the private. So how did it come from the public side into the private side and violate you, all right?
Okay.
And that's something that you need to be aware of,
okay.
All right? So I do hear what you're saying, sis. I'd like to get more into your case, but we got other callers, and, of course, our time is short on
Thank
this
you.
Excellent Blog Talk Radio. And you're very welcome.
I'll be calling you.
Yes, and your name?
Zara.
All right, sis. Mm-hmm. All right, sis. I'll be listening out for you.
All right.
Okay, brother, I'm going on to the next caller because the brothers and sisters are coming in, and we're going to area code 317. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what question or comment.
Yeah, you hear me?
Yes, sir. We hear you. Loud and clear.
How you doing, brother? My name is Mike Kauf from Indiana. I had a quick question.
Okay, go ahead. Let us have it.
I've been hearing a lot of information about this birth certificate thing and all this Q-ship number. Some people say it's valid. Some people say it's not. And how you can draw income off of it or whatever. And, like the government took out a bond on you and you can retrieve the bond, stuff like that. Actually, there's a book out that's raising a lot of controversy, whatever. Some people say it's not legitimate like that. I just wanted to know your take on it, if you got any information on it, how, if you can, is it true that you can retrieve, redeem the bond for your benefit or whatever?
Yes, brother. Let me share something with you, brother. I went outside today to go purchase something, and I'm a person, I really don't buy the newspaper, All right? But while I was out here today, I picked up a newspaper, and in this newspaper, it was an advertisement. And the advertisement, brother, had something to do with a firm that deals with bonds, with municipal bonds.
Right.
And what I'm doing now, and I'm turning to that article that I read, and a lot of us are taking secondhand or third-hand information, and I'm a person that I would listen to secondhand or third-hand information, but I don't take it on face value,
right?
As is, but what I will do is I will take the information and I will look into it. And
okay.
When I look into it, I will find out for myself if that information is valid or not. All right. Now listen to this, brother. I'm going to read something to you from this article from a newspaper that I picked up today.
Okay.
All right. And of course, the ancestors always want me to see something, so they'll show me something. It's to prove to the people what's going on. All right? This is called Triple Tax-Free Municipal Bonds. Call for offering and free consultation. Also available for discussion on the following topics is yield curve and interest rate strategies. One, bond laddering. Two, all right, then you have three, is special situations, distress investments. In high yield bonds. Four, CDs and investment grade opportunities. Five, bonds 101 and different types of bond markets. Six, portfolio reviews and CUSIP analysis. CUSIP. So it's just ironic tonight, brother, or as we say, as Moore's Law governs all events, how you call me to ask me about a CUSIP information. And here I am reading a paper, and this particular company called BB&T Capital Markets, all right, the vice president is giving information on a toll-free number concerning portfolio reviews and CUSIP analysis. So, again, how could this be not valid if you have companies out there who is aware of the CUSIP number and using the CUSIP number? But I would be the first to tell you, brother, but I've been in what you call the Global CUSIP Services Conference, May the 15th of this year at 55 Water Street down here in Manhattan. All right? I've been at the conference. They had several conferences this year. I only got a chance to get into one of the conferences, a place that's very difficult to get in. All right? And I have material from the conferences. And that's why I said that when I have this video stream, a live video stream, I will make this information known and shown on the live video so people can actually see it. Now, when you talk about the birth certificate, you're wonderfully correct, brother. The CUSIP number is a number that's assigned to all of these instruments that's out there. It could be the birth certificate, the death certificate, the marriage license, the driver's license, your mortgage loan, your student loan, your credit card, your bank account. Brother, I could go on and on and on and on and on. And this is something that I have studied and researched myself, and this is coming from the Europeans. This have nothing to do, this is not no second-hand, third-hand information that I got from some more or someone else that's making mention of this knowledge. This is something that I went out on my own, brother. All right? So it will be second-hand knowledge to you because you're getting it from first-hand knowledge from me. You see what I'm saying? And I won't be making the information available. We got about four people in my class who have their CUSIP numbers. I can get the CUSIP number for you for $400. That CUSIP number isn't a very expensive number. Who deals with CUSIP numbers is what you call a securities attorneys. The securities attorney charges some serious cash for it, all right? One securities attorney that I'm aware of charges $20,000 for your CUSIP number. All right, but I can get that same CUSIP number for you for $400 because we have a network on how to get that CUSIP number. All right, one brother in my class has his CUSIP number on his driver's license, and the driver's license fund is in the billions of dollars. The same thing with another brother with his mortgage. All right? So we have various brothers and sisters in the class who are applying and getting their QSUP numbers so that way we can be able to tap into that fund. All right? Because the monies are they're available, but there's a process on how to get those monies. All right? And I'm working on that. It's called structured finance. You have to structure this knowledge and information together in order to get this, but you have to be in the right place, in the right agencies, with the right applications, the right language, in order to get what you're seeking to get, brother, because a lot of brothers and sisters are just haphazardly just putting information together and just throwing it out there like though we are testing grounds. We don't need that, brother. We need proper knowledge and proper education on this science.
Okay. Now, the brother, he can't respond to you because I had to cut it off because we had a lot of background noise. But
yes.
I'm pretty sure that you have answered the question for him, Brother Bay. And I'm going to
yes.
go on to the next one so that we can get on down into the meat of the situation here.
Yes.
Area code 904. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment? Let us have it.
Hi. My name is Sharon Hunter Bay out of Jacksonville, Florida.
Hey, sir.
And, hey, how you doing?
I'm fine.
All right. I wanted to ask, make sure I understand this thing about when you go to the courtroom and they try to assign you a lawyer, you're not supposed to accept that? And am I supposed to get my own personal representation or any representation by an attorney will make me fall up under the jurisdiction of the court?
Well, that's a good question, sis. And see, this is the reason why Morris have to come together, sis, because my Morris sister, because that's one of our weak points as Moors out there, is that a lot of us is not going to be studious enough to study this law to defend oneself. You know, one thing that C.M. Bay had stated, I read a lot of his literature. He put together a Moorish constitution also, and something that he stated that I read where it says that a Moor is well qualified to defend him or herself, and that a Moor should not hire a white or Negro lawyer, because for a Moor to hire a white or Negro lawyer would be surrendering birthright to the court. All right, this is what C.M. Bay has stated in his literature that I've read many, many years ago. All right, and so C.M. Bay had invoked my thoughts to that. All right, so that's one of the problems we do have. What we need to be setting up, sis, is our own judicial counsel. All
right.
Right. Our own body, you know, where we can come in and, of course, show that you have counsel, all right, that you have counsel to address whatever issue. And that's what Moors need to do all over the states. Moors need to get together and start putting together counsel, Moorish counsels together, all
right,
right. Where, and it's easy. Just put your Juro Society together or your Mural Society, M-U, R A L, as opposed to J U R A L, we can put our Mural Society together. But there's a way we can do it, sis. Moors can do it. And the Moors are not organizing themselves to put a Mural Society together to address whatever issues we may have in our community with whatever accusations, be it criminal or civil. Moors should set that up, you know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, you remind me of a book that I have in my library. It's called The Jews of Islam. And in this book by Bernard Lewis, he talks about that, how, you know, when Moors were subjugated into a Christian system, but they were still in the position to represent their own in their own society if they were being accused in a Christian society. All right? And that's what Moors need to do, since we really need to organize in Florida, in California, in Texas, in Jersey, New York, Virginia, you know, PA. We need to organize a Mural Society, all right, you know, which is Moorish jurisprudence. That needs to be established, and then we need to contact the administrator of that court, all right, and let them know that any Moors who are going to have any issues as far as the state is concerned, that this is going to be the council, you know, who's going to come forward, you know what I'm saying, for that Moorish sister or brother. This is what we need to put into place, sis, because it's just disturbing that a brother or sister who has the knowledge that they are Moor and yet can't go into the courtroom and can't demonstrate Moorish law to vindicate themselves away from the Christian courtroom, because it is the Crusade War still going on against the Moors. We just don't make seeing in that light because things have been reconstructed. But since we do need to organize a mural society, Moors need to start doing that.
That's a good idea.
You know, okay. Sis, very needed.
Okay.
All right. Well, sis,
thank you.
I hope you've answered your question, Sharon. And
yes.
I'm on. Okay. How's it going up there in the snow?
Before she leaves, Brother Tahaka, Sharon, yeah. I also want to say, even I don't want it just to be a good idea, my beloved sister, but what I want to say to you is that whoever's the Grand Sheik, you know, from the Moorish Science Temple, I don't know if you're affiliated with the temple because we have Moors who are in temples, we have Moors who are not in the temple, but to me, whatever Moorish association or affiliation that we have, you need to go back to that body of Moors and say, listen, we need to structure a moral society, all right, and make it public record that we're going to represent as a council, a body council for Moors, right, in whatever case they may have. That's very important that you'll come together. So it's not my idea, sis. It's our idea, all right, something that we must move on. So since you got this knowledge and information now, sis, as a light to you, just bring that to the Moorish community where you at in Florida, sis, and tell them they need to organize a moral society, all right, and start drafting that up in the form of a declaration or a proclamation, you know what I'm saying, so that way Moors can start counseling Moors as a council when it comes to these issues, if it comes to civil or criminal, all right? So I have
okay.
to say that, all right, sis? So I just want you just to share that with you before you leave.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Appreciate
all
you,
right.
too.
Okay, brother, before we get on back down into the meat of the situation, can you tell the listening audience where to go on YouTube to actually see you deliver? And I think you got about five different plugs on there. You and Brother Abdul, where you actually deliver this thing step by step and get into all the nitty gritty details. What do they have to type in YouTube and actually see this thing?
Well, it's interesting, Brother Tahaka, that you asked me that. And what one needs to do, which is very simple, is, of course, pull up YouTube and you go into, of course, the search bar, and you would just type in my name, Kemeti U, K like in ketchup, E, M like in Mary, I, T like in Tom, U, Kemeti U, and then Bey, B-E-Y. Once you type that up, you're going to see a whole list of YouTube pieces that's been put up. I don't really know who put it up there. I didn't put that up there, but apparently it had to have been Abdullah who might have put that up there because he has access to all my classes, you know, and, of course, there was others who had access too, just besides him. I can't say it was him for sure, but it was brought to my attention that I was on YouTube with the classes. Prior to that, I was on YouTube because BCAT in Brooklyn, it's a Brooklyn cable station, I was sitting in a panel of 15 people, and, of course, they decided to take that clip out of that panel, you know, and focus that one on me because what I was deliberating was unheard of, and they was interested in it, and they wanted me to come back again. You will see that I'm wearing a red shirt with a red fez, all right, deliberating some knowledge and information. That was really the first YouTube piece that was put up, and that was by Brooklyn cable station called BCAT, all right? The other ones that you would see, of course, that was when I was actually in Philly giving classes every Monday. I think it was about 14, possibly 16 classes, and I think all of them, posted up there, and you would actually see me deliberating that live. I also have two other DVDs of me actually in the law library, and I want to go back there again for the third time, all right, with a more, with a camcorder, to camcorder me so that way I can deliberate more information out of the law library. But I do have a DVD when I'm actually in the law library and I'm actually expounding, all right, with law books, pulling them off the shelf, showing you actually the cases, how you cross-reference them. You know, I'm going to see if I can get that up on YouTube so people can see that demonstration, because most of us don't even know nothing about a law library or even walking into a law library, let alone looking up any cases.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this right here. Now, this is what I want to know. And I'm pretty sure that all of us got their seatbelt fastened on this one. 99% of the time, how do you go about winning your cases? What caused you to win your cases 99% of the time when you're inside the courtroom on the floor actually doing this?
All right. It all depends on what court you're talking about, all right? So if it's a criminal court, let's start with a criminal court, and then I move into the civil court to give people an idea of what's going on, because I can't make a generalized statement because it depends on what courtroom that you're referring to, because the procedure in these courtrooms are slightly different. It's not too much of a difference. There is a slight difference, but because they all have their own administrative procedure, you have to know the procedure in that courtroom, all right? So I have to articulate that. So I don't want people to be misled or misguided that what I'm saying in the federal, in the federal court will apply in the state court, or what's going on in the criminal court will go on in the civil court. So we have to articulate that and make it clear so people won't be confused. All right. Now, say for instance in a criminal court. All right. Normally, what I would do. All right. If I'm being accused of a crime. All right. And I want to be able to have this case thrown out. Normally, what I would do, right, is I would have to get the charges first and see what the charges are, because that's very, very important. All right. Once I see what the charges are, all right, of course the court is going to have you to go through these procedures of arraignment, maybe a bond that may be involved or whatever the case may be. But once you start getting past all that, then there's an issue where you're going to have to file what you call is bill of particulars, all right, a bill of particulars. A bill of particulars, which is a disclosure application, which means a motion, but it has to be done within the criminal statute, all right? In New York, they have what you call is the criminal procedure law, all right? It is a certain procedure, all right? And so once I begin to start reading the procedures, 9, 10, and 10, you're going to find your relief in those statutes. The same statute that they use against you is the same statute you can use to win your cases. Like I have a case right now that I'm helping a more with, I'm assisting a more with, 170.35 of the criminal procedure law. They pronounce that as CPL, all right? That statute deals with motions to dismiss, all right? If there's a defective instrument, all right? Like, for instance, what is a defective instrument? A defective instrument is referring to whatever the instrument may be as far as the complaint. If the complaint is drafted up with errors in it, or if, say, for instance, there's a traffic ticket, they normally like to bring that into criminal court, all right? And if any information in there is inaccurate or misprinted, all right, or there's any errors in it, if the statute was cited wrong, you know, something to that effect, you can file a motion, all right, within the criminal procedure statute of your state, all right, and have that case thrown out, all right? Of course, with this notice of motion, your affidavit in support, all right, and, of course, you're going to cite the statute showing where the information is inaccurate. Of course, you're going to use whatever instrument they're using against you. That would be your Exhibit A attached to your affidavit with your motion, All right? And 9 out of 10, when you actually follow that procedure, they would dismiss the case. 9 out of 10, they would keep the case kind of on the quiet side because they don't want the court to know how the procedure is done. Because 9 out of 10, when you're sitting in criminal court, and those who have been sitting there, like myself, you can see that a lot of the people that's in the courtroom really don't know what's going on. They just be either go along with what the court is telling them or an attorney is representing the case. And, of course, the attorney always keep you in the blind side and you don't know what's going on. But when it comes to your case specifically, I will put your case together. I will show you the procedures. I will show you the statutes, the form, all right, and what you should be looking for in the dismissal of your case, all right? Normally what I do is I use their procedure, all right? I use their statutes, all right? I do have a way of don't have to use their statute, don't have to use their procedure. But there's a reason why I do use their statute and they use their procedure, and the reason why is because the fact that using their statutes and procedures is to show them that they are obligated in law to acknowledge that statute or procedure. But the problem is when Moors put their own arguments together arbitrarily to the statute or to whatever the pleadings may be, they're wondering why their cases are being disregarded because it looks like they're not coherent. You know, 9 out of 10, when you're in a criminal court and if you're not coherent or responsive in a pleading to the correct answer that they're looking for, all right, they would say that in New York they call that 7:30. In another state they may call that something different. What I mean by 7:30, psychiatric evaluation. Each state have a statute that refers to psychiatric evaluation. Well, in New York they call that 7:30. Every state have where they subjugate you into some kind of psychiatric evaluation to see if you fit to stand trial. The only reason why that happens, and it's very important that you notice, is because they know that you're not applying the proper procedure, the proper motion. It's like you're coming in the courtroom being reckless. You just, you know, you can't come in the classroom, all right, and if the course for that day is going to be social studies. You cannot be talking about math in a social studies forum. And that's exactly what Moors be doing, is that they're coming for a forum not knowing the statute, not knowing the procedure. And, of course, these people have gone to law school. And because they go to law school, they know the statute, they know the procedure, they've been trained to do this, and we are not being trained to do this. And so when we go into their forum and we put in these writs and we put in these affidavits and they read these things, they say, oh, there's a problem with this person. He's not complying. He's not doing this. He's not doing that. Can you defend yourself within that procedure and statute? Yes, you can, but you have to know the statute. You have to know the cases. Matter of fact, how do you know if that statute is enacted or no longer active? Maybe that statute expired, and we have to find out through the State Department if the statute is still active. Is it bonded or is it not bonded? All right? These are the things that you need to know. All right? So it all depends on the case. Now, on the civil process, that was from the criminal perspective. On the on the civil, something similar. You got the same type of similar situation. But when it comes to the civil, in order to win a civil case against an agency, you must put in what you call is a notice of claim. All right? If you're being damaged by agency, like, for instance, the sister was talking about in New Jersey, she had an issue against Child Protective Services because they got something against her. All right, she has to put in a notice of claim for the statute that applies for notice of claim within the venue and jurisdiction where she's at in Jersey, and that goes for the same thing for whatever state you're in. You must put in a notice of claim. Why? Because when you bring it to federal court, because if they're acting under color of law, you definitely got to go to federal court. One of the actions or one of the motions they're going to apply to abate your claim is Rule 12b-6 motion. The Rule 12b-6 motion is plaintiff failed to state a claim where relief can be granted. All right? And so the question is, what did that mean? What did they mean by plaintiff failed to to state a claim where relief can be granted. That means that in order for you to implicate a suit, either state or federal, to that agency, you must give them notice of claim. What is a notice of claim? A claim is a lien. You're making a lawful lien, which is a claim, same difference, of the damages that was done, all right, to that agency first. You send it to them notarized, certified. Or you can go into the agency, let them, you know, you file that with them, and you make sure you have your duplicate of original, let them stamp it, have it in your files. You must file a notice of claim. Why? Because according to their law and their statute, I don't care what state you're in, they must give you what you call is a settlement conference on your claim that you're making against the agency. Because why? All those municipal agencies are all insured. They have to be insured. So because of the insurance policy and you making a claim for any of the damages, they must give you a settlement conference on your claim. If they don't give you a settlement conference on your claim, the other option they're supposed to give you is what you call is a right to sue letter. So if they don't give you a settlement conference, they got to give you a right to sue letter. But that can only happen after you give them what you call is prior notice to your lawsuit. All right? Because 9 out of 10, the reason why we are losing these lawsuits in federal court or either the state court is because of the fact that we have not served them a notice of claim. This is their general rule for all municipal corporations across the United States. You must serve these people a notice of claim, brother.
Okay. Now, tell us about federal.
In federal court, yes, I'm with you, Noble. Listen, if you want to start an action in federal court, it starts off again, excuse me, with a notice of claim. Whatever agency you are suing, even if it's not a state agency, all right, say for instance, it's a bank, which is federal, or a car dealership in another venue, a jurisdiction outside of the state, and you have to sue them in federal court, all right? Or say, for instance, if there's a credit agency within another venue outside of the state venue that you're in, you have to send them a notice of claim. Notarized, certified to a receipt. Once you send them a notice of claim, they have 30 days to answer that notice of claim. If they don't answer that notice of claim within 30 days, then you can commence what you call is a federal suit against the defendant, be it a state agency, which is governmental, or either a non-governmental body, which is a private corporation, all right, or even if it's a public corporation. You can sue them, but you must serve them a notice of claim before you can bring it into federal court. In the federal court, there's a procedure, all right? You have what you call as a complaint, all right? Then you would have to have what you call is your civil cover sheet, and then you would have to have what you call is your summons, all right? And then you would have to have what you call is your affidavit of service or a certificate of service showing that you served the other side. It's a lot involved. We don't have enough time, technically. I would really like to show this on the board, but we can also go to United States District Court, whatever district you're in. I don't know if you could be in the Western District, the Eastern District, the Southern District, or the Northern District. You can type in whatever district federal court you're in, whatever state you're in. They do have a website, and when you go to the website, they would have a section there that deal with what you call as pro se. They do have a section there that deal with forms such as a complaint form, summonses, the civil cover sheet, all right? They even have what you call is a pro se manual, All right, it's online. You can put in the federal pro se manual. It comes up in PDF form. All right, and they do show you exactly what the federal civil complaint, verified civil complaint looks like. They will show you what the summons look like. They will give you the civil cover sheet. All right, this is all in the pro se manual. So if anybody wants to have an idea what it looks like, all right, you can go to the pro se manual in the federal court. All right, it will come up for you online. All right, for whatever state you were in. All right, so I, of course, I'm in domicile here at New York State. All right, and of course, I deal with both the Southern District and the Eastern District. So it don't make a difference what district I'm in. I can pull it up, look up the pro se manual. You can do the same thing within your state. And again, like I said, you can pull up the pro se manual, and when you browse around in the pro se manual, all right, you're going to see the forms. You're going to see the form. Like, for instance, when you see the complaint form, they're going to show you about the statement of the case, the relief, the causes of action. They're going to give you what you call the body of your complaint. They're going to give you different titles to the body of your complaint. You'll see that there, all right? But, again, I would love to go into more detail. The time is of the essence, all right? And not only that, I can go into more detail, but it's something that is visual, all right? Because I teach etymology and I teach epistemology. Epistemology means how would one know knowledge. So visualization is one science of how we know knowledge, and this is why the board is so important. And, of course, etymology is important because now etymology deals with the origin of words, the historical origin of words, and this is how I begin to start to defeat these attorneys because they're using terms and words in a way where you can decipher these words and you can actually destroy an attorney in a courtroom by studying the science of etymology because since he's a wordsmith, all right, and if you have the science of etymology, you will automatically know how to look at these terms and these words, all right? I'll give you an example. Like, for instance, here say, for instance, the judge says in the courtroom, what is your residence, all right? Again, Black Folk Dictionary, 6th edition, or any one of those editions. Look at the word res, all right? R-E-S. Res is a Latin word meaning thing. Ident, all right? Ident is what we would call identity, all right? So they're identifying you as a what? A thing. All right, so that's an etymology example to show that you don't have a residence. All right, you have a domicile. All right, and the address is always Kairos. All right, always Kairos. Technically, I don't even like to use the address of my domicile because when you use the address of your domicile, this is how the court usurps jurisdiction over you because of the address of the domicile. All right, but that's another issue that we can go into because this issue is concerning jurisdiction. But, again, brother, like I said, Tahaka, it's a learning process. To know how to implicate a federal suit is a learning process. To defend yourself against the opposing party, that's another process, all right? Because if he wants to implicate what you call is a summary judgment against you, you have to know how to defeat a summary judgment. You have to know how to construct a summary judgment, you know, or a motion to dismiss. It's a teaching tool. It's really a teaching tool.
Okay. Well, this is what I'd like to ask you at this point. Now, I already know that you have a ton of ammunition and a whole battery of guns. So what I would like you to do is if you would be willing to come back and give us a breakdown on the terminology. I've already spoken to Brother Abdul. He has agreed to come on and give us his take on etymology. And I know you have that too. If we can do part two to this broadcast, will you be willing
yes.
to do that? I know you're busy men. Okay. All
yes,
right.
Look,
so,
I'm never too busy to Tahaka for my Morris family out there. And I thank you for the honors for allowing me to be on your Block Talk show. Just let me know when we can have part two, brother. You know how we talk. You just hit me on the hip, like you say. and we will make a reservation so that way our brothers and sisters can be on the air just to listen in on how we're going to demonstrate this etymology, so I can empower our brothers and sisters with this word.
All right. Well, now we got about 27 minutes. So what I want to lay out first is let's take a case in point, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the average brother and sister that's out there that's in turmoil and walk them out of turmoil. So we're going to say that the brothers and sisters, they've been studying. We're going to say that this brother, he's driving down the street. Okay, he got a ticket. But he did not give the officers any driver's license. However, he did give them a world citizen passport issued by the World Services Authority coming under the Declaration of Human Rights. He didn't give them a driver's license. He wasn't rude. Everything went okay. But they said, well, you were driving. He says, I'm exercising freedom of rights to travel. They issued tickets. And so he turned around and he sent the sheriff a bona fide affidavit with about 22 points of law. And the sheriff then announced in 20 days he turned around and sent a default notice with right to cue a couple of times. Didn't answer. Then he sent him a notice of dishonor. What would he do next?
All right, listen to this, Brother Tanaka, because I have to ask you some questions, too, because Sheriff, I used the term earlier in his relationship to the fourth edition of the Black Spell Dictionary, and I have to stress this because I want everybody to be clear. One is called the Blind Eyes Doctrine, all right, and the other one is called Altered Eagle, because when I hear you using such language as reference to the traveling, a right to travel, and, of course, being stopped by Rome, and, of course, they're going to start hitting you with these tickets, all right? And, of course, they're going to start drafting up some type of misdemeanor complaint in reference to whatever traffic violation that they're claiming, all right? Now, normally, Noble, I have to ask this question so I can be clear to give you a proper response, all right? I don't want to be off base. Normally, in a setting, and I've been in several states, when a traffic violation ticket is being issued, they normally want you to come to court, correct?
That's right.
So listen to this carefully. Who would normally would litigate that matter against you would be the DA, the prosecuting attorney. All right? And I'm going to tell you why I'm making mention of that. Because the brother who had the World Service Authority passport and everything he having is proper and is legal, but these people choose not to honor it. It's all good because he still has the right to travel in his legal capacity, his legal and lawful capacity. All right? So that's all right. But now here's the sign. Let me show you how these people will recognize it. First of all, he was never supposed to send anything to the sheriff, because the sheriff is not the one who's litigating the issue against him, all right? The sheriff is only the issuing officer. Who is going to be bringing issues against him would be the DA or the prosecutor, all right? And those instruments need to be directed to the prosecutor, because they're the one who's going to be prosecuting the case against the brother or sister who received that traffic infraction. Now, what normally what I do in a case like that, all right, is that's why I always tell people I need to see the ticket. Because in the ticket, it specifically tells you that there's a tax ID number, right, on that ticket. Somewhere on that ticket is going to show you the officer's tax ID number, all right?
Okay.
That's a problem. Why? One, everybody who's listening to this needs to go to DMV and get a copy or purchase a copy of the vehicle traffic law from DMV. In New York State, they want $2.50 for our vehicle traffic law. Everybody in their state must go and get the vehicle traffic law. There's no possible way you're going to have standing in these people's courts without that law. All right? I do hear about right to travel and all these different case laws going back in the early 1900s concerning your rights to travel. These people is not going to listen to it because it's going to fall on a deaf ear. Why? Because, first of all, what these people are looking at is finance. So, according to subsection 209 of the vehicle traffic law of New York State, because if you travel here in New York State and you get stopped under the same circumstances, they're going to issue you a vehicle traffic violation ticket. All right? But what you need to know is that DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicle, is nothing other than the Taxation and Finance Department. So now when you start to realize that and know that now, because they're defining that for you in the vehicle traffic law, now you know you're dealing with what? Finance and taxation. All right? So listen to me carefully, family. The sheriff's office or the police officer or whatever public officer who's serving you a vehicle traffic ticket, you must find out by going to the Department of State and typing in whatever agency they're from. You'll see the name of the agency in the Division of Corporations from whatever state you're domiciled. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a non-for-profit. This is what I'm saying. It's going to be a non-for-profit foundation. You will see that. If you look up the title of the name of the sheriff, look that up in the Division of Corporations in that state and see how they incorporate it. And once you see how they incorporate it, or even the town's attorney or the city's attorney or the county attorney, all right, look up that town, that city, all right, or that county, whoever's prosecuting the ticket. Look at the Division of Corporations. See how they incorporate it. And if you see if they're non-for-profit, 9 times out of 10, the sheriff's office is non-for-profit. 9 times out of 10, the prosecutor's prosecuting you is a non-for-profit. Why is commencing you bringing all this issue up? Because it's all dealing with finance. We're too busy fighting these things as points of law in the form of an affidavit, but we're not looking at the financial part because, again, Article 3, Section 2 says, the judicial power shall extend in all cases in law and in equity. We see the law part, but we don't see the equity. Why am I bringing up these issues? Because a non-for-profit, be it the sheriff or the prosecuting attorney who's prosecuting that ticket, right, in the name of the state of whatever you domicile at, is doing it as a non-for-profit, which is in violation of the internal revenue laws of that state. Why? Because it's a non-for-profit, and a non-for-profit cannot hit you with fees, penalties, and surcharges, all right, on a ticket in a non-for-profit capacity. So you have to look at it from that perspective. Once you look at it from that perspective, you're going to begin to start to what? Win your case, all right? Because, again, it's non-for-profit. They cannot collect profit in a non-for-profit capacity. That's one defense. The second defense is normally on the ticket it would say whatever state it is. First of all, that's the altered ego doctrine. The altered ego doctrine means that the prosecutors is prosecuting the case on behalf of another agency, but is not even doing it on behalf of another agency. They're doing it in the name of the people, all right, of whatever state. That's an altered ego doctrine violation. Impossible. Can't do it. But they do it every single time. That's what you call a RICO concession. They're holding RICO concessions. What is RICO? Racketeering influences of corrupt organization. That's exactly what's going on. They're charging you extortion. All right? They're extracting, which means extortion, fees from you, penalties, fees from you, illegal, in the name of who? The people. First of all, what people are you referring to? Are you talking about the people being incorporated, which is a fiction of law? Because as it says that Legal representation is a fiction of law, and where there's a fiction of law, truth cannot stand. All right? So therefore, that's called self-incrimination. You are the people. You cannot stand against yourself. They can't have the people of the state of versus Jane Doe or John Doe. Why? Because, again, that's self-incrimination. So that's linguistic apartheid to separate you from the people as though you ain't the people, to prosecute you away from the people. That's called linguistic apartheid. You can sue them for that, all right? That's your second defense. So there are numerous offenses there that you can use to defeat whatever action they have against you, all right? But, again, the greatest defense that we have is that we have to start making sure that the vehicles that we're traveling in, the automobiles that we're traveling in, or the land vessels that we're traveling in, by law, you should have a bond to indemnify the vehicle. Because once you indemnify the vehicle by a bond, none of those statutes or laws would apply to you, and that's also in the vehicle traffic law. All right, so there's numerous of defenses, brother, that can be established to defeat any action against these people. But my whole thing is not just to defeat it, but once you defeat it, we must bring lawsuit against them. For every action they bring against you illegally, we must bring lawsuit, because a non-for-profit cannot make profit with these fees, penalties, and surcharges that they're implicating inside these courtrooms as RICO concessions.
Okay. Well, all right. I certainly appreciate your breakdown to the umpteenth degree on that thing. And I've been beating them for years here in the state of Florida because, to be honest with you, brother, they just ain't that smart. But anyway, I want you to come back again. But what we're going to do is I'm going to go on to the next question for you. You do such a thorough job on asking the questions, and we are here to deal with the federal seizure, civil procedure, Title 28 U.S. Code. Could you just give us, we only have 14 minutes left. Could you give us a quick breakdown on that, and then we're going to see if we have time left. Left to ask a more question. Could you give us a breakdown on that?
One of the questions concerning civil procedure. What is civil procedure? All right. Civil procedure is dealing with the statutes, rules, and regulations of the court. That's what the civil procedure is all in a nutshell. It deals with the regulations, right? Rules, regulations, all right, and statutes, all right? That's exactly what the civil procedure is. Criminal procedure, same thing. When they talk about criminal procedure, when they talk about civil procedure, they're talking about rules, regulation, and statutes. That is what it's talking about in a nutshell. Rules, regulations, and statutes. That statute could either be a civil statute, or that statute could even be a criminal statute. They're talking about rules, regulations, and statutes. All right? Not only that they're talking about rules, regulations, and statutes, they're also talking about form. All right? Because it has to be in a certain type of form. It don't make a difference if it's civil or criminal. I'm saying that to say if you're in a criminal court, you have to look at the rules, regulations, statutes, and the form. All right, the form that's being used. Same thing with the civil. Rules, regulations, statutes, and the form. The same infrastructure that you have in the civil procedure is the same in the criminal procedure, but you have to apply it according to whatever statute it is, if it's criminal or it's civil. It's just plain and simple. Once you begin to start recognizing that, like for instance, like they have what you call is the local rules of the court, all right? And you should get the local rules of the court, all right? Look into it. You know, you can go right online and type in whatever the rules of the court is, all right, in reference to if it's a superior court, all right, or a court of common pleas, all right. Usually the lower courts, they don't really too much get into what you call the rules, but they do have a procedure, which would most likely will be their rule, that you can look into, all right, because you'll find something different in those lower courts, much different than, like, the superior court or the court of common pleas, all right, or the Supreme Court, all right. In PA, they got the court of common pleas. New Jersey, they got the superior court. New York, they got the Supreme Court, all right. Various venues label the court differently, but technically they're really all the same. You just have to look at whatever rules, regulation. Like, for instance, let's go to federal court, for example, all right. They will use what you call is Rule 12B, all right? 12B rule. That's a rule that most attorneys, if not all of them, use to defeat your federal case, all right? And then, of course, you will read the rule, all right? With the rule, there's some statutes, all right? There's some forms, all right? Is the forms there? Yes. It's a rule there, yes. It's a procedure there, yes. Well, all that is the procedure. The procedure is the rule. The procedure is the statute. The procedure is the form itself. So until you know what the rules are, until you know what the statutes are, and until you know what the form, those three make up the procedure. Without those three, somewhere along the line, you're going to have an error in the procedure, and that's when the court is going to hold it against you, all right? So the rules, the regulation, and it's the statute and the form, all that comprises of the procedure, civil or criminal. That's what they call the governing law, all right, that I'm giving you in a nutshell. This is how they govern their courtrooms when it comes to litigation, either civil or criminal. That's what they use as the governing law. All right? You have any questions from any callers?
Okay, no, I don't have the switchboard for any more questions. But can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Noble.
But this is the question I need to ask. Let's give we only have 9 minutes left. And we only got 4 minutes to ask this and get it answered. But what if I go into the courtroom, challenge status and jurisdiction of the court, don't enter into the record, but I hold up my birth certificate, I got my affidavits down, filed into the court, I've already placed my last will and testament, I'm executive of an existing estate, the judge has the estate letter and everything else, and I have not understood filing proper procedure, but then the court has accepted this, it's in the hands of the judge. What happens next?
Listen to this, Noble, and I hear what you're saying. Let's look at the preparation first, because the preparation is the key factor. I've said this before, and I say it again. Let's look at the preparation. You brought to my attention, and for those who are listening, a certain type of procedure and application with the instruments that you are seeking to implicate in reference to challenge and jurisdiction.
Okay.
Now, this is what we should be looking at. All right. First of all, the Attorney General is one, and two, the Court Administrator. The Court Administrator is really the one, along with the Attorney General, those are the two individuals within the state where you need to establish your status, all right, to let them know. You're putting them on notice. You're not, it's not for saying, well, we recognize your status. No, we don't need them to recognize our status. We already know what our status is. What you need to do is put them on notice of your status, all right? The Attorney General of that state where you domicile and the administrator of that court, the court administration. The court administration is how the courts are being administered. All right? That's important.
Okay.
Because that's where you start at, Noble. You don't want to go into the court and say, I'm going to put this in court record to say this is what I'm establishing in reference to my status in reference to jurisdiction. That's not where
okay.
you start at. Where you start at is who, find out who's the court administrator, the head court administrator, all right? Then you begin to start to put them on notice concerning your status and also the attorney general of that state, all right? Reason why I'm saying that specifically, because if you have a case that is coming in court, the attorney general of that state, all right, because the attorney general represents both sides. He represents the criminal side and the civil side. That's the reason why you put him on notice. And the reason why you put the court administrator on notice, because the court administrator is the one how the court conducts its business, all right? And that court administrator could either be administrator for the civil court or for the criminal court. That's the court. That's the agency that you will begin to start to putting them on notice concerning your status. When you talk about the birth certificate, all right, of course, people don't seem to be aware, especially when they talk about Uniform Commercial Code, which is UCC-1, which is the financial statement. They don't know, brother, and this will be the first time people out there who's listening would hear this, because I've been hearing all kinds of other ways of doing a filing of a UCC-1 on the birth certificate. People don't seem to realize, brother, you must make the attorney general the debtor, and then you will be the secure party. Because under the doctrine of parens patria, go to the sixth edition of the Black Law Dictionary, look up parens patria, P-A-R-E-N-S, parens, and then patria, P-A-T-R, right?
Right.
I-A-E, patria. When you look up that doctrine, you're going to see that the attorney general has what you call is parent patria, all right? So he would have to be the debtor, all right, to your birth certificate, and you would be the creditor, which is the secure party to your birth certificate, all right? So you have to go to, it's a must. The attorney general and the court administrator are the parties who you put on notice concerning your status. So if any litigation goes on in that court, you must go to those two agencies first in order to get your case defeated or you, in order to win your case in court.
Okay. Well, brother, I certainly appreciate you being here and delivering this very, very powerful information. I'm going to have to bring the broadcast to a close. But, ladies and gentlemen, the brother have agreed to come back. We're going to do part two of this thing so that we can get down into the nitty-gritty. And, Brother Abe, I certainly thank you. And
yes.
I think we have put enough information on the record. I'm going to call you, and we're going to set this thing up again for part two.
Yes.
And I have other brothers that's in here that's got the hand raised. Brother, we're not ignoring you. We're going to get into it and let you in. But tonight we're going to have to bring this thing to a close. So, ladies and gentlemen, I've been your host, Tohaka Manayel Bay. And until next time.
Mm-hmm.